Okay, so what I'll do, I'll try to describe some interesting new insights that we have on the effect of galaxies on the hydrogen in the universe, relic from the Big Bang. As you well know, after the universe aged at about 1 million years following the Big Bang, it started being dominated by neutral hydrogen. Before that, the hydrogen was ionized, collisionally ionized, photoionized by the CMB. And then somehow, by a redshift of 6, it was all ionized again by the first sources of light. Now, this is commonly described as the process of reionization. What I'd like to focus on today is something a bit different. Galaxies had a big impact on the state of neutral hydrogen even before that time, as I'll describe later. The very first sources of light formed in the intersection of filaments and sheets, the high-density region. This is a snapshot of the universe at a redshift of 20, and you see these pockets where molecular hydrogen starts to form and condense and make the first stars. And the atomic hydrogen is the simplest atom we know about, but yet if you consider the ground state, you can either have the electron lined up with the proton in terms of the spin orientation or being opposite. And that gives you two states. So the ground state of hydrogen is split into two states. And these two states are separated by a small amount of energy corresponding to a photon wavelength of 21 centimeter, or 1.4 gigahertz. Turns out to be very useful. This was predicted by van der Hulst in 1944, observed actually at Harvard in 51 by looking at the sky. People observed it. And since then, it has been very useful in astronomy. What I'll try to describe is how we can use it to study the very early universe, the conditions in it. And in particular, this is a natural extension of the microwave background. The studies that are being done nowadays, actually, it gives you much more information than the microwave background. So I think the future is with 21 centimeter cosmology. And in particular, one can describe what is the fraction of atoms in the upper state versus the lower state. And that's given by this Boltzmann factor, where the denominator is called the spin temperature. It tells you how much, which fraction of the atoms are excited to the upper level in terms of the Boltzmann factor represented by this temperature, where the separation between the levels is a small fraction of a degree Kelvin. It's 7% of a degree Kelvin. That's the separation between the levels. And the ratio of statistical weights of the two levels is 3 because of the spin states. Now, the excitation rate involves both atomic collisions and radiative coupling to the microwave background. At very early times, both of these processes operate. And the question is, which one wins? Atomic collisions couple the spin temperature to the gas temperature, the kinetic temperature of the gas, while radiative coupling to the CMB couples the spin temperature to the microwave background temperature. So here we have a competition between two processes that couple the spin temperature to different temperatures. They're not the same. The microwave background, here you see actually the evolution, the thermal history of the universe. The microwave background temperature drops as 1 plus Z with redshift. And below a redshift of 200, the residual fraction of free electrons is not sufficient to keep the gas at the same temperature as the microwave background by Compton scattering. So the gas starts to cool below the microwave background, this 1 plus Z squared. You see that as the dashed blue line here. And the spin temperature interpolates between the two. At early times, it's closer to the gas temperature because of collisions. And then at around the redshift of 30 or so, the spin temperature goes back to the microwave background because of the Hubble expansion. The gas is diluted, so collisions play less of a role. And so the spin temperature starts with the gas temperature and then goes back to the microwave background temperature. And that's very important because the brightness temperature of the gas in the sky is proportional to the optical depth of the gas to the 21 centimeter transition, but also to the temperature difference between the spin temperature and the microwave background temperature. So if the spin temperature is lower than the CMB temperature, you get absorption. If it's higher, you get emission. And as you see here, it's lower. Before the first sources of light were lit up, the gas absorbed the microwave background. Now, the gas is not uniform. It fluctuates. It has regions that are slightly denser than the mean and regions that are lower density than the mean. And so you get a power spectrum of brightness fluctuations of the 21 centimeter absorption. And you can describe these brightness fluctuations by, again, expanding in Legendre polynomials like you do with the microwave background. So you can slice the universe at a given redshift and ask what would be the brightness fluctuation power spectrum on the sky in this slice. And what you get are fluctuations that go up to the level of about 10 millikelvin. Remember, this scale is very different than the scale of microwave background fluctuations, which are 10 microkelvins or so. Here we are talking about 10 millikelvins. They are much larger fluctuations because the optical depth is of order a percent, and the spin temperature deviates by a factor of order unity from the microwave background. So we are getting a big effect. But there are more serious problems to do with foregrounds in this context, and I'll touch on them a bit later. So anyway, you get some power spectrum of density fluctuations that induces power spectrum of brightness fluctuations of 21 centimeters on the sky as a function of the multiple index. And by the way, this is before galaxies formed in the universe. So we can see these fluctuations at a redshift of between 30 and 100. There is a window of opportunity between redshift 30 and 200, where the spin temperature is below the CMB temperature. And you can see that the multiple index goes all the way up to a million or 10 million. That's a huge value compared to what the CMB allows us to see. We are talking here about arc seconds. The bend here is due to the Jeans mass. We can go all the way down to the Jeans mass and observe the gas fluctuations, while for the microwave background, we can't do that. We can't go to such small scales because of silk damping. And the nice thing about this method is that you can slice the universe at different redshifts by observing different wavelengths or different frequencies. The wavelength you observe is 21 centimeter times 1 plus z, and you can map the three-dimensional distribution of neutral hydrogen. So you get a three-dimensional mapping in difference from a two-dimensional mapping of the microwave background. That's an enormous advantage in terms of the amount of information that you can get. All together, you can get 10 to the 16 independent patches on the sky. That's how many independent pixels exist down to the Jeans mass on the sky. Right at this moment, if we were to uncover this signal, we would get, this is the richest data set that exists in astronomy, as far as I know. The microwave background goes only up to L of order 10 to the 4 or so because of silk damping. And if you count how many independent regions, because it's two-dimensional, you get only 10 to the 7. And the difference is huge, 9 orders of magnitude more information in the 21 centimeter brightness fluctuations, as far as they tell us about the initial conditions from inflation that seeded structure formation in the universe. There is the issue of foreground, and fortunately, the foregrounds are assumed or usually are observed to be smooth as a function of frequency. So they have a smooth spectrum usually, while the 21 centimeter fluctuations change whenever you shift a little bit in frequency because you are going to a completely different cut through the universe that sees different density fluctuations. So that's a way of getting rid of foregrounds with smooth spectra. Now, the one thing about 21 centimeter fluctuations that people for some reason missed in the literature until recently is the fact that it's not just these fluctuations are not just sensitive to the density fluctuations. If you have a region which is denser than the mean, it has a density that is larger by a factor of 1 plus delta, that's not the whole effect. So you have the optical depth that appears in the brightness temperature expression. It's proportional to the number density of hydrogen atoms in the universe. And that obviously gets modulated by 1 plus delta in a region that is denser than the mean. But actually, if you work out the formula, there is a sensitivity to the inverse of the Hubble parameter, the derivative of the velocity with respect to radius. And that comes from the Sobolev approximation to anyone that has dealt with line transfer in moving media. There is a dependence on 1 over the Hubble parameter in this context. Now, in the past, if you look at all the papers until very recently, until this paper where we worked it out, this dependence was assumed to be just the Hubble parameter. But in fact, the Hubble parameter, the Hubble expansion rate, is also fluctuating from place to place, and it gives you a fluctuation. For example, in a spherical collapse model, you get a change in the Hubble parameter that is 1/3 of delta. So the correction to the Hubble parameter is of the same order as the correction to the density, and you have to take that into consideration. It's not enough to include only the density perturbation. This is not the effect of redshift distortion that people often talk about in galaxy surveys. It's not because you are moving gas elements in redshift a little bit, you are shifting them. It's because you are changing the Hubble expansion rate locally in an overdense region. And the correction factor is the same as for, is the same order as for the density. And this effect was missed in many papers. If you go over the recent literature, they missed this additional correction. And it's important. So for the unity correction. So this correction actually introduces anisotropy to the power spectrum. And why? Well, if you consider a K mode, it has a particular direction of propagation for the K vector of that mode if we take a Fourier transform of the density fluctuations. And this direction defines an angle relative to the line of sight to the observer. And so the derivative of the radial velocity along the line of sight with respect to the distance along the line of sight would involve, when you take the Fourier transform, would involve twice a cosine theta factor. So you get a cosine theta squared into the power spectrum of fluctuations. There is a dependence on the angle relative to the line of sight. The power spectrum is not isotropic if you take peculiar velocities into account, because we are sensitive to peculiar velocities along the line of sight, the Doppler effect. And so when you put this together, you find that there is a term proportional to cosine theta squared in the power spectrum, and there is an isotropic component to the power spectrum that is related to the density fluctuations, for example. And when you take both of them and square them, you end up getting terms that are of order cosine to the fourth, cosine squared, and a term that is independent of the angle relative to the line of sight. And these allow you to separate contributions to the power spectrum that come from different sources. In particular, the dependence on cosine squared theta comes from peculiar velocities, so you can isolate that. You can isolate the contribution from structure from the contribution associated, say, with fluctuations in the gas temperature or other things which are presumably isotropic. And that's an important advantage of this method. Another important effect that has not been considered in the literature has to do with the possibility that you couple the spin temperature to the gas temperature through Lyman alpha photons. So if hydrogen atoms absorb a Lyman alpha photon, then this excited level, N equal 2, of the hydrogen atom can decay into the other level of 21 centimeter. And by that, you can couple the spin temperature to the kinetic temperature of the gas. This is a well-known Wuthuizen field effect that was discussed in the some 40 years ago. And it gives you, in principle, another coupling mechanism through Lyman alpha absorption and emission through Lyman alpha photons of the spin temperature to the kinetic temperature of the gas. Now, you realize that the brightness temperature is related to the difference between the two. And so if the spin temperature turns out to be very large because the gas is heated, then you pretty much don't care about the spin temperature. The brightness temperature is the uniform brightness temperature is constant, and then it's being modulated by density inhomogeneities. Now, before this stage is approached, before the spin temperature becomes much larger than the microwave background, there is an intermediate stage where the spin temperature starts to heat up because the gas is heating up and it's coupled through Lyman alpha photons to the spin temperature. And the Lyman alpha photons, the important thing about them is that they are also fluctuating. The intensity of Lyman alpha photons is fluctuating from place to place because galaxies are not uniformly distributed in the universe. So that there are regions where there are more galaxies and regions where there are less galaxies, fewer galaxies. And also there are Poisson fluctuations in the number of galaxies. So if we consider a given point in the intergalactic medium, there is an effective horizon out to which galaxies can contribute to the Lyman alpha flux at that point. And that comes from the fact that galaxies farther away would send their photons that would resonate with Lyman beta before they get to this point, and therefore they will be blocked. They will not reach that point. So only galaxies within the Lyman beta, a distance equal to the separation in redshift between Lyman beta and Lyman alpha, are able to contribute to the Lyman alpha flux at that point. And within this volume, there are fluctuations in the galaxy distribution that you have to account for. And of course, as you go farther away from that point, you go back in time because you're dealing with retarded time. In order to observe the intensity at a given time, the photons must have been emitted earlier. And since there are, of course, there is a very rapid evolution in the abundance of galaxies at those early times, there is a rapid evolution in the number density of sources relative to this point that you have to take into account. We went through all the relevant details and worked out the power spectra of density of brightness fluctuations that you get from the fact that galaxies are not uniformly distributed in this intermediate phase where the Lyman alpha photons start to couple the spin temperature to the kinetic temperature. And you get a big enhancement in the power spectrum of 21 centimeter brightness fluctuations because of these additional fluctuations in the Lyman alpha flux. There are two contributions. I will not have time to discuss all the details here. But one is that galaxies are biased at early times. There are rare peaks that are much more clustered than the mass. So that's one contribution to the fluctuations. And the second has to do with Poisson fluctuations. The number of galaxies is small as you get closer to the point of interest, and you get large Poisson fluctuations that enhance the 21 centimeter flux. And you get typically the dashed line here indicates what the power spectrum would have been without the effect of the fluctuations in the galaxies. And you get an enhancement by a factor of a few, typically, which is significant because a factor of a few in the amplitude of the signal means that you have to integrate if it's a factor of three, you need to integrate nine times less. The signal-to-noise ratio goes like 1/√ of the integration time. So just to sketch the thermal history of the gas, the microwave background, of course, goes like the temperature of the microwave background goes like 1 plus Z. And then the gas temperature, as I discussed before, dips below the microwave background temperature. And then the gas gets heated, most likely by X-rays emitted by the first galaxies. X-rays coming from X-ray binaries, from massive black holes, from all kinds of possible sources, gamma ray bursts. So you don't need much in order to heat the gas above the microwave background temperature. And that happens long before the medium is ionized. The X-rays can penetrate into the intergalactic medium. So that's the kinetic temperature of the gas. And then the spin temperature interpolates between the two. The initial stage is associated with good coupling between the spin temperature and the gas temperature due to atomic collisions. And then once the universe rarefies, as it expands, the spin temperature goes back to the microwave background temperature. And then, once again, it gets coupled to the kinetic temperature through the Lyman alpha photons emitted by the first galaxies. So there are three stages in this process, and we can explore all of them in principle. The first stage has no galaxies. There is a window of opportunity to observe the primordial fluctuations imprinted by inflation before galaxies formed in the universe. And that gives you much more information than the microwave background. As I mentioned, in principle, you can get many more pixels of independent regions in the sky in 21 centimeter than given by the microwave background. This is a very exciting opportunity to study non-Gaussianity from inflation, to study the nature of the dark matter, whether there is hot dark matter or not. On small scales, you can probe the physics very nicely with 21 centimeter. And then there is the stage between redshift 30 and redshift 20, where X-ray heating starts to bring the kinetic temperature of the gas above the CMB temperature. That's not difficult because we are dealing with milli-electron volts. So you just need to supply very little energy in order to heat the gas above the CMB temperature so that it emits 21 centimeters rather than absorbs. And at the same time, there is Lyman alpha coupling of the spin temperature to the kinetic temperature. So H1 starts to appear in emission against the CMB. And then the final stage by which galaxies affect the intergalactic medium is that associated with reionization. And that's the commonly discussed topic. But what I wanted to emphasize is that galaxies could have a big influence, especially on 21 centimeter emission or absorption, long before they ionize the universe. So we can study the impact of galaxies on the universe with 21 centimeter at much higher redshifts, much before the universe gets ionized. It's a much richer data set that allows us to, in principle, study the interplay between galaxies and the intergalactic medium. And the nice thing about the 21 centimeter is that we can slice the universe as a function of redshift. So if you imagine the process of reionization as being associated with blowing H2 bubbles, making regions of ionized hydrogen in an otherwise neutral medium, it's just like a Swiss cheese. I mean, that's the analogy I like to draw. And you can imagine cutting the Swiss cheese, and but simply in the context of 21 centimeter, you observe a different wavelength. You therefore slice the universe at a different redshift. And if you choose the frequency separation so that you slice the universe just on the scale of a characteristic bubble at that time, H2 bubble, then you can learn a lot about the bubble size distribution. So what you want to do is slice the Swiss cheese on the scale of the holes in it in order to figure out what is going on. Then you will see big changes from one slice to another in the topology of these walls. And there are actually four experiments with one very futuristic one that are planned for the next few years. This is becoming a very active field, very appropriate for young people to get involved in, because in principle, I think it will substitute current studies of the microwave background. Frankly, I don't understand why the microwave background community is not jumping on this opportunity, and why experimentalists that work on microwave background that more or less got exhausted by now are not starting to work on 21 centimeter cosmology. This is a much more exciting frontier. It allows you a three-dimensional mapping of the universe at very early cosmic times. And the experiments are done either in Australia. This is a collaboration between MIT, various institutions in Australia, and the CFA. There is LOFAR in the Netherlands. Some people are worried that the only thing that this instrument will detect will be the radio stations in Europe, but there is hope. I mean, they are far more advanced than the other groups in terms of developing the technology. There is PAST that is designed to be built in China, the enhanced VLA, and then, of course, in many years into the future, the square kilometer array. By the way, if you were wondering who this is my collaborator, Stuart Wyeth, that these days on every Tuesday or so, he's working on actually cutting steel, actually building up the instrument for the Milora wide field array. So he's also doing some interesting physical work, not just theoretical, as you might have thought. So let me address in the remaining minutes what we know about the ionization of the universe, which is the only probe that we currently have before these instruments will be built. There are several empirical hints. We don't know what the second year data from WMAP will tell us. All of us know what the first year data was interpreted to tell us. In fact, by now there is data on the third year as well. And in fact, what I want to see is a separate group of people analyzing the data. Once they become public, it makes much more sense, to believe the implications if a second group arrives at the same conclusions. It's not so much seeing the WMAP team coming up with a consistent picture, but seeing independent teams arriving at the same conclusions with the same data set. So far, the polarization data was not made public, so we are waiting for that. But at any event, if the analysis will demonstrate the same conclusions, then it argues for an early process of reionization at very early times. However, there is conflicting evidence, and the conflicting evidence comes from quasars at around the redshift of 6, above redshift 6. In particular, the highest redshift quasars found by the Sloan survey. Basically, what we see is evidence for the ionized spheres around these quasars, and the size of the ionized region that the quasar creates depends on two things. It depends on the age of the quasar, how long was this bubble blown by the quasar, and it depends also on the neutral fraction of the surrounding medium. If the medium is neutral, the bubble expands more slowly because the quasar has to ionize more atoms. And you can write down the equation that describes how this bubble expands. It starts relativistic and then it slows down to non-relativistic speeds. Now, in the spectra themselves, if you look at the spectrum, for example, the 6.43 quasar, there is a region starting from the redshift of the quasar, which in this case is identified by a CO line that is emitted by the host galaxy. So you know the redshift of the host galaxy very well. There is a redshift interval over which there is Lyman alpha transmission. And this redshift interval over which there is Lyman alpha transmission tells you that there must be an ionized region around this quasar, being the H2 region that the quasar creates, so that you would get this transmission of Lyman alpha photons, beyond which there is enough neutral hydrogen to suppress the flux altogether. So from this, you figure out the size of the H2 region, which turns out to be 5 physical megaparsecs around these quasars. And you can translate that to a constraint on the neutral fraction of hydrogen, given the typical quasar lifetimes that were inferred in the literature for quasars. There are various methods to infer the quasar lifetime. All of them give lifetimes around 10 to the 7 years, usually. And if you take this lifetime and you consider the bubble sizes for at least 2 quasars, by now we have 6, above redshift 6, you find this solid line here that gives you the probability of having a neutral fraction smaller than a certain value. So the probability of, if you consider this solid line seriously, the probability of getting a neutral fraction less than a half is of order 10-20%. It's very small. So most likely, the universe is more than 10% neutral at that redshift, redshift 6.4. Because otherwise, these bubbles would not be 5 megaparsec. If the universe had a neutral fraction of 10 to the minus 3, as the Gunn-Peterson trough tells you, the minimum value that the Gunn-Peterson trough tells you, then the bubbles would have been 10 times bigger. They would have been 50 megaparsecs, not 5 megaparsec. The reason they are 5 megaparsec, the only plausible reason, is either that the medium is more than 10% neutral, or the quasar lifetime, for some reason, is only 10 to the 5 years. But that is very unlikely. Of course, we can observe in principle with 21 centimeter the shells around these H2 regions. And that would be a very nice confirmation of this picture where we infer the neutral fraction indirectly. With 21 centimeter, we can actually observe the neutral fraction directly at those quasars. One last point that I would like to make has to do with the size of the ionized bubbles at the end of reionization, the end of the process. Consider it to be redshift 6. There should be, you can imagine on the sky, a surface beyond which the medium is ionized. This we call the surface of bubble overlap. At early times, you have small bubbles that percolate to become bigger and bigger. Eventually, they overlap, and this surface is fluctuating on the sky. How can we set a constraint on the size of a bubble at the end of the process? This size of a typical bubble determines the fluctuation amplitude of these, or the curvature of this surface. And the way to infer it is using two arguments. First thing is, if you consider a bubble and imagine a 21 centimeter photon emitted from the edge of the bubble, propagating through that bubble. Now, this photon needs a certain amount of time to go across the bubble. If by the time it gets to the edge of the bubble, it sees neutral hydrogen, that means that this photon was not emitted from the surface of bubble overlap. There was a photon closer to us, 21 centimeter photon, that could have been emitted later. The only way for this photon to be representing the surface of bubble overlap is if everything is ionized along the path of the photon towards us afterwards. So what you want is that the variance, the cosmic variance in the time by which regions of that size get ionized, so the fluctuation in the time by which these photons, these regions get ionized, to be smaller than the light crossing time of a bubble. In other words, if you plot the time it takes a photon to cross a bubble, of course, as you increase the bubble size, it takes more time for a photon to cross it. As you increase the bubble size, the fluctuations in the universe on this scale become smaller and smaller. So as the bubble size increases, the crossing time increases as well. It takes more time to cross the bubble. Here you can think of this axis as the time. So it takes more time to cross the bubble as you increase the bubble size. At the same time, the fluctuations in regions of that size in the universe become smaller and smaller as the bubble becomes bigger and bigger. And so the scatter information times of bubbles of that size becomes smaller and smaller. And there is a point where these two curves cross each other, where the cosmic variance becomes smaller than the time it takes to cross a bubble. And at that point, the photon will never see a hydrogen, neutral hydrogen region, because the time it takes it to cross a bubble would be longer than the variance in the formation time of bubbles of that size. So this point represents the characteristic size of a bubble at the end of reionization. And what you find is that it's roughly 70 megaparsec, co-moving megaparsecs, or about 10 physical megaparsecs. And that's important for 21 centimeter studies. The current observational limits are consistent with this. I don't have time to describe it, but basically they are represented by these shaded regions, and they are just allowing this theoretical prediction of a typical bubble size of order 10 megaparsecs physical, and a characteristic redshift scatter in or curvature in this surface of the end of reionization of order 0.15 or so. This paper is to appear in Nature within a few weeks. So I think I'll stop here because I don't have much more time to discuss other issues. Thank you.
With regard to the predictions of 21 centimeter signal from the epoch before Lyman alpha pumping, you left out one, which we have discussed in the literature, and that is that matter which is collapsed into virialized halos, mini halos, for which the virial temperature is less than 10,000 degrees, will be neutral, but dense and collisionally pumped. Right. As a source of 21 centimeter emission. And not only are they a source of a background of emission, but it will fluctuate because the mini halos cluster and they are enhanced in their fluctuations by the bias of the mini halos.
No, I fully agree with you. It's just that in the 30 minutes that I have, I cannot describe. I just try to describe the new things. I didn't have a chance to overview the discussion that exists in the literature, and you're perfectly right that the mini halos can make a significant contribution to the signal.
As part of the other questions?
Avi, I'm a bit confused by your argument concerning the size of the bubble around the 6.4 quasars, because from the size of the bubble being small, you infer that the X1 fraction has to be larger than 0.1. But on the other hand, the bubble size is also limited by the time it takes for the line to travel. So in 10 to the 7 years, you get only a size of 3 megaparsec, which is
roughly 30.
right? C times T is,
yes,
10 to the 7 years is 3 megaparsec.
No.
Well, it's physical, right? Physical radius.
10 to the 7 years.
It's 3 megaparsecs.
No, I think it's more. It's 30, isn't it?
Three. Should be 3. 3 times 10 to the 10 by 3 times 10 to the 14.
Well, but this is, okay, this is
so
actually...
the size of the bubble limited by the growth and not by the X1 fraction. That was my question.
No, no, no. So what you have to remember is that we are looking along the line of sight to that quasar, right? And the quasar sends out photons, ionizing photons, ahead of the photons that we are looking at right now. Okay? Remember, all the photons propagate at the speed of light. So, the quasar may be turned off by the time that the photons reached the edge of the H2 region. You are not observing it at that time. The photons are chasing each other. So as long as there was an interval of, say, 10 to the 7 years, over which the ionizing photons were able to create or carve out this H2 region, the photons that go after them will see an ionized bubble up to any radius that these first photons reached. No, the lifetime of the quasar is completely separate. The quasar is active for a certain amount of time. You can imagine that during this time, the quasar sends out photons, okay? And you can imagine a shell of photons propagating out from the quasar. The quasar is dead by now. There is a shell of photons, radial shell of photons moving out. The front of this shell is ionizing the surrounding medium. The back of this shell sees an ionized medium up to some distance. Okay? So it has no relevance. The quasar died already. This shell of photons can ionize the medium out to any distance that it can. In principle, the light travel time is irrelevant. The only issue is, you know, if you solve the equations of radiative how far does the ionization front go during the time that corresponds to the thickness of this shell of photons? Okay? Do you see my point? Okay.
Neutral or
no? So in this scenario, we basically assume that there is a, since we are talking about a bubble that is very large, 5 megaparsecs around the quasar, you know, it's 5 times 6.4 plus 1, which is 7.4. We're talking about 40 megaparsec bubbles in commoving scale, very large scale. On this scale, you know, if the universe is partially ionized by galaxies, each galaxy has a certain bubble around it. So the issue is, what is the filling fraction of ionized bubbles in the universe at that time? And that's what we call the mean neutral, the mean ionized fraction, or 1 minus that is the mean neutral fraction. And we're basically saying that on very large scale, there is a certain fraction of the gas that is ionized on average, on large enough scales. And the expansion of the bubble into this medium depends, the expansion rate depends on that neutral fraction, right? And so, so we allow it to be any value, and then we find that it cannot be very small, because otherwise the bubbles would have been 10 times bigger. It can, the Gunn-Peterson trough constraint says that the neutral fraction must be above 10 to the minus 3 because of the opacity of the intergalactic medium. But that's, if you were to allow 10 to the minus 3, the bubbles would have been 50 megaparsecs rather than 5. Right. Right.
The optical depth would be not so large. It would not be 10 to the 5. You wouldn't see that.
No, but the bubbles usually H2 regions, if you take a characteristic quasar spectrum, okay, the H2 region has a sharp boundary. If you ionize by X-rays, you may be right that the bubble is not sharply defined. But,
yeah, but you say the proximity of the quasar till actually the optical depth gets so large that it's absorbed.
Right.
You're not sure that that's the edge of the H2 region, it's just that the flux has
right.
dropped to a level that the optical depth is large.
No, but if you saw the...
not necessarily 10 to the 5, but it could be 10 at that radius and then go gradually, and that would be very hard to dig out of the spectrum.
No, but if you consider the expansion of an ionization front, the neutral fraction changes very sharply at the surface. If you were to solve for the structure of the ionization front, it will change very dramatically from the background to a much lower value, the neutral fraction. On a very narrow...
But you haven't seen the charge transition in the spectrum.
Well, in the spectrum, we do see it. Let me show you. Well, I have to go back a little bit. Okay. So this is the edge of the H2 region, right here, this sharp thing. Now, there was another paper following up on our paper by Zoltan Hyman and one of his students, trying to analyze the actual shape of this H2 region, both in Lyman beta and in Lyman alpha, comparing Lyman alpha to Lyman beta. And they arrived in a consistent picture. This is the edge of the H2 region, right here. The idea is that the H2 region extends this distance. Now, peculiar velocities are irrelevant. We are talking about a few thousand kilometers per second separation from the quasar position. Large scale inhomogeneities are not relevant because this is a huge scale. You know, it's 40 comoving megaparsec. Even today, the density fluctuations are much less than unity on such scales. And so that's a representative volume in the universe. That's a big volume, in the chunk of volume in the universe. And we just couldn't see what can go wrong, except arguing that perhaps quasars have shorter lifetimes than 10 to the 7 years. That's the only way I can see out.
I don't disagree if you're really sure that you've seen the sharp edge there, but I said I'm not yet convinced of from that data. I think I appreciate that what Zoltan said, that's the right thing to do. But I think from that quality of data, I think we haven't seen that yet.
Now, the other thing that has to be mentioned, in principle, you can get a sharp edge also from a Lyman limit system that happens to stay just at that distance. But then it would be very peculiar that you find the same extent of the H2 region for two quasars. And in fact, by now, there are six. So for the two highest redshift quasars, you find the same size of the H2 region for roughly the same luminosity, which gives you a consistent value. And now there are six, and we are just about to finish a paper that involves more quasars, and they all seem to point out to the same conclusion. We don't see much scatter in the conclusion between different quasars. So either there could be something systematic in the way that we interpret these spectra, but there doesn't seem to be large variation from quasar to quasar.
Yeah, so if the neutral fraction at a redshift of 6.3 was 0.1, can you then account for the Gunn-Peterson type observation
yes.
that show that the optical depth vanishes around a redshift of 6?
Yeah, that's something I didn't have a chance to get to. But basically, all you need for that purpose is an extended period of reionization. And I have to skip over this. By the way, what you've just missed is why we shouldn't believe numerical simulations. You will hear more about them. Numerical simulations of reionization, they are limited in the size of the simulation box. If you can ask me. Right, so let me get to answer Chris' question. Here. So here is an example. Can we turn the lights off? Here is an example for a reionization history that gives you a large optical depth. Basically, at a high redshift, for example, you have a population 3 episode that produces an ionized fraction. This is the ionization fraction by mass or by volume of order tenths of percent. So it's not complete reionization, but partial. But it's extended. You start at a redshift of 20 or so. And it continues, and then you shut off population 3, and you start to build up again the ionizing flux by population 2 stars, which are much less efficient. So it takes a while, and then by a redshift of 8 or so, or redshift 6, you completely ionize the universe, depending on the parameters. This kind of history, in fact, if you calculate the contribution to the optical depth to electron scattering, you find that the initial phase is dominant over the late phase, because the universe is much denser early on. So even partial ionization gives you much more. This is the visibility function, tau dot e to the minus tau. And So failed overlap gives you more than a successful overlap. And with Stifler Lanetta, we try to answer exactly your question of what whether double reionization can be accounted for with physical models, where you either suppress population 3 by enrichment, metal enrichment, or by some radiation background, photoionization heating or H2 dissociation. And we find that double reionization is quite unlikely. You really need extreme parameters. But extended ionization, a process by which you ionize it partially and then it continues, later on this is the ionized fraction, is quite plausible for a large set of parameters. You can get extended periods of reionization that are not complete until relatively late, redshift 6, 7, and that you can do, but probably not the double reionization, because for that you need the universe also to recombine in between the first episode and the final episode of ionization. So you can have regions, particular regions that recombine, but this is the mean on average in the universe. It's much more likely that the universe, if W map is correct, the universe went through an extended period of reionization.
So,